Senate Committee on Judiciary, Monday, February 10, 1975, 8 AM, room 407A.
Please don't come to order, I'm just calling in.
Rosenbaum? Carson?
Two.
Cook?
And.
Bailey?
Newton, moving to the center.
Robert?
And.
Smith?
And.
Johnson?
Look at, Senate Bill 257. Mr. Olson, sitting on behalf of the office. Is Judge Beatty here?
He's over on the right, yes.
Judge Connell? John Barnes?
They're all coming together, all coming together. The soldiers brought the afternoon.
Is John for Article 1? Representative Wilhelm, which bill were you?
Article 13, the third on what?
Oh, you want to come forward?
Regarding the present motor vehicle code that deals with bicycle passengers, and since you're going to be dealing with this subject today, I thought maybe I could pose the problem to you. I do not have a proposed solution because I talked with Mr. Millett about it, and we're not sure just exactly how to address it. We thought maybe you could consider doing a deliberation. But I would call your attention to Section 123, found on page 53. Lines 29 and 30, where it talks about a unlawful bicycle operation. In effect, the person propelling a bicycle commits the offense of unlawful bicycle operation if he carries more persons on the bicycle than the number for which it is designed and equipped. And I don't think any of us argue with that. However, this constituent had contacted me, had been stopped by the police because they had had one of these jump seats that you can buy and attach to the back of the bicycle. You know, they fit over the back fender and you haul your child around the neighborhood while you're tooling around on Sunday afternoon. I've done it for years myself with all my children, never realized I was in violation of the law. I'm sure that the hundreds of people that are doing it do not realize they're in violation of the law. And in fact, they may not be. However, this one person was stopped by the police and written up for it. Now, I don't know what the answer might be. We had talked about changing the wording to designed or equipped, but that might open up more problems than we can solve it. But I did want to call the problem to your attention because I think it is something that could possibly be straightened out since we are now going through rewriting the code. And I'm sure it's not a common occurrence that everybody is playing around like this and getting pulled over, but it is a nuisance to those people who are. So I would just call that problem to your attention, Madam Chairman, and hope that maybe your committee could address itself through that and possibly work out some kind of words that would solve that problem.
Did this person get a ticket?
Well, they related that to me, yes, ma'am.
Senator?
Gary, I was wondering,
the thrust of your concern goes towards the jump seat behind rather than riding two children riding or on someone in the handlebars or on a crossbar. You have no difficulty.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I don't think that should be changed at all. This would just deal with those jump seats, which are bolted and mounted tightly and securely to the bicycle. And you can't pack anybody in them that weighs more than about, I would guess, 30 pounds at a maximum.
I understand that I've observed some people carry their children on a backpack or a bootboard. I would assume that would be all right too, as long as they were on the body of the mother or father or whatever.
That came up this morning at breakfast. We were talking about this, and a young man brought up the fact that he did pack his daughter around that way when she was small on the backpack, and we didn't know how the law would affect them. And I don't, I wouldn't hazard a guess.
About my new marsupial pack. Yes. They have a firm grip on the ear.
But anyway, the purpose of my testimony is to cause your attention and hope that you possibly can do something to maybe straighten this out and probably solve the problem for the enforcement people as well as the as well as our constituents.
Well, if you have any ideas, you're welcome.
Oh, okay, if I come up with any of those errors next year, I'll make sure that you receive it.
Okay, thank you. Good question. Thank you, Representative. Dear Coughlin,
my name is Dick Hoffman. I'm the manager of the Portland Bicycle Advisory Committee. I'd like to have Robert Scotton, who is the chairman of that committee, speak with you today. Bob?
Right.
Hello, Chairman. Bob Scotton, citizen of the Bicycle Advisory Committee in Portland. I wanted to comment on two parts of the bill, primarily. I might say that this has been discussed by the advisory committee. The one, 125A, with regard to writing single file, you probably received a letter from our committee dated 31 January 1975, and Maybe the wording of that could be something the effect of told writing in single file when a motor vehicle is traveling in the same direction, approaching within 100 feet. Part of the rationale for that being that in many areas of the city of Portland, it's reasonably safe to ride two abreast. To restrict a person to riding single file in all cases may not be a total necessity to be safe. Maybe it would be a kind of a law that would be unenforceable, maybe by giving some sort of stipulation that when motor vehicles are approaching or something of that type, would allow this kind of a option to the rider and still provide the aspect of safety I think that the law is trying to get to. The second point that I'd like to comment on is 125 section 3, it talks about when a bicycle lane adjacent to the roadway or a bicycle path adjacent to the roadway has been provided, bicycle riders shall use that lane. I think it's kind of a restrictive kind of a requirement for bicycle riders. In many cases, at least again in the city, the lanes that might be provided are the kinds that are not adequate for the whole gamut of bicycle riders. What I'm saying is, if there is like a sidewalk trail provided, and many of us that commute on bicycles are used to riding, you know, with the traffic 15, 20, 30, 40 miles an hour, whatever the case might be, some of the younger people 30, 40 miles an hour, using such a trail is a real obstacle, and in short, it would not be used. I mean, the people would go ahead and see it in the traffic.
In the traffic.
Beg pardon?
The thing that concerns me about that is, and I realize the problem, we had testimony last week from some important people on that. You're familiar with a bill passed, I think, in 1971, provided, 1973, funds from the Motor Vehicle Code,
right,
to provide bicycle paths.
Right.
One is not the only justification for taking automobile drivers' funds and giving them to bicycle riders' benefit was that it provided, wherever we put them, it provided a separation from the bicycle and the automobile. And that was, in part, if not the sole justification for taking gas tax funds to build bicycle paths. Now we've had testimony that that's not the way it ought to work, that the bicyclist ought to get his choice to ride either on the highway or on the bicycle path. And if that's where it's going to be, then I wonder what happens to the justification of a bicycle path.
Well, it's my feeling you're talking about two different things. You're talking about going from here to Rickreall. You know, using that trail is probably the way to go. It's safer. The trail is adequate for virtually all kinds of bicycle riding. I think we have some kind of unique problems in Portland because of the millions or hundreds of miles of roadway that we're talking about. We're talking about a matter of space where we to have a separated trail is in some cases virtually impossible. What I'm saying is I think that the rider needs the alternative of electing to ride in the traffic, you know. I don't mean dodging in the traffic, but I'm using the same facilities as the automobile. If that is a more feasible way to go. To be very honest with you, we're having a very difficult time implementing the trail plan in Portland.
Well, let's take the Rickreall one. That's probably the safest highway to ride on anyway, even if we didn't have a bike path, because it's a great width of highway. It's only recently been improved. And so, in my judgment, even if we didn't have a bicycle path, it'd be a safe highway compared to a lot of the ones you cover. The concern I have is we spend the money to build the bicycle path, and then if we don't have something like that, then what do we accomplish? Because some citizen may say, I don't like the way that winds back and forth, I'm going to ride on a highway. And if there is no prohibition, why build the bicycle path?
Well,
or why tax the automobile driver and owner to build a bike path?
Well, I think we're learning a lot about in open state about bike paths, you know, what is a bike path, the engineering of it, and so on. Many of those that we have built, well, even one in particular, Trail Your Bike Trail that was built in Portland, is in many respects unsafe for a rider to ride in terms of the other kinds of obstacles that are put up. The fact that it's because of the way the original bill was written, that is both a foot trail and a walking trail and a bicycle trail. So you have people streaming down the hill. The path should have been built up the hill, but you know, they're going down the hill. Where the bicycle can maneuver down the hill 20, 30 miles an hour safely, and if they're required to be on that path in a park-like setting with joggers and walkers, it can create a more difficult kind of a bicycle facility than if the bikes were allowed to be ridden on the street. I hear what you're saying.
One of the senators came right next to me, and he and I have had a number of discussions about the fairness and justification of taxing the driver. We do not now tax the bicycles in any size, shape, or form. And the testimony we've had on this, quite frankly, I think asks the question, this Florida thing, I've seen it, and I appreciate your concern, but I guess maybe we ought to abandon the bicycle path, because if we can't get the bicycles off the highway, even if we build a bicycle path, then I don't think we can justify taxing them on this.
You're putting me in a kind of an either-or situation, and I don't see it as an either-or situation because I see bicycles, as a viable means of transportation. And particularly in the urban kind of a situation where parking is a problem, these kinds of things, it does offer a good, viable means of transportation commuting to and from downtown. And if we have good trails developed, I think that they will be used without a law. If we have a law and we have lousy trails, I think we'll have an enforcement problem because people won't use it.
How about this? How about if we rewrote this to designate, give the authority to the city, county, or highway and state to, when the engineering is done, take the risk of all the hoses and explosives and have them post no bicycles on the highway. And then you have no choice. And if you get caught on the highway with your bicycle, you can be arrested. But maybe the coordinator or the highway authorities would agree that the footpath is not suitably designed or the bike path, and therefore they leave the alternative open.
Okay, let me offer another suggestion back to you. How would it be to risk the bicycle here without giving them some sort of right to be on the highway?
If there's some justification to fix and tax them.
Yeah. I mean, that's something else we could think about. When we got in this business of designing trails and trying to determine who we were going to design them for, we had in our original task force people that went screaming down the highway on their bikes 40 miles an hour. We had people seeing this as bicycles, you know. And we have some of the very conscientious mothers seeing bicycle trails as being a safe place for their 7-year-old to get around with their banana seat bike, you know, and encourage them to do. And I think we're still involved in some of that kind of dialogue about what is a bicycle trail. I think what I'm talking about here is I'm concerned with the possible development of a bunch of curb cuts or something like that some of our city people view the only way we're going to bicycle trail, and calling that a bicycle trail or path or whatever, and restricting commuters to this kind of a facility, and just a lot of headaches when we're trying to put them up under that, you know, constant curb jumping process, crossing traffic every 250 feet. And if they were out moving like a vehicle in the right side of the lane, even though it's not separated, they would be moving through it at the going speed of traffic. I myself drive very often on Sandy Boulevard, right from 64th and Sandy downtown, and
operates like a vehicle. And I mean, it's just like a vehicle in terms of speed and physical frequency.
Is there any other affections that you want to
talk about? That's essentially it. I mean, like I said, I think you have a letter from Mr. Hoffman, our president of our committee.
Thank you,
Chairman. Yes. John, could you just note for the record that we couldn't amend subparagraph 3 of section 125 to provide that would be a bicycle lane or path exclusively or designed for exclusive bicycle use? That would at least resolve the problem if you had joggers and walkers on that same path.
Barbara Dirker.
My name is Barbara Dirker, and I'm representing the League of American Humans. I don't know that I have a lot to add to the last week we testified. Section 125, paragraph 1, subparagraph A, right in single file, I would agree that that should be amended in some way. In what way, I'm not exactly sure. Perhaps it could be something like requiring that bicyclists ride in single file when the speed limit exceeds 50 miles per hour, or possibly it could say ride in single file except where traffic conditions permit otherwise, or something of this nature. But there are county roads that are lightly traveled, and if you've got a group out for a recreational type bicycle ride, then I think to require people to ride single file in all cases is a little bit restrictive. Then, with respect to 3, subparagraph 3, a paragraph, and what are those called? Are those called paragraphs when I have
subsections?
I feel that this, what we feel that this paragraph should be deleted, and I think the problem of equity between the motorist and the bicyclist, and whether it's fair to appropriate funds from the motorist for the benefit of the bicyclist, and then let the bicyclist run on the highway. I think what Senator Brown said might help that a great deal by inserting the wording that riding on roadways, bicycle paths and lanes, and then insert that these paths and lanes are for the exclusive use of bicyclists. I think that would help, and but it's the quality. In many cases, the main problem is the quality of the bicycle path. In the city of Ashland, for example, the bicycle path that runs down the main part of town, Sixth Boulevard, is a sidewalk, which just has the asphalt curbing put in so that you don't have to stop your bike every time. But there are lots of pedestrians on the sidewalk. And an additional problem is that the city of Ashland decided that bicyclists had to yield to motorists, even though motorists have to stop at the stop sign for every residential street. Comes on 60, even though there's a stop sign there, the bicyclist must yield right of way to the motorist. Well, there are probably a dozen little streets coming in to view, so that it's quite a lengthy process getting from Southern Oregon College campus, for example, to downtown Ashland. Stop frequently, and there's a confusion as to whether you should stop or shouldn't stop. So many people, especially people who are in a hurry, just go right down CCU Boulevard. There's also the problem, if you're required to use a bicycle path, you could be presented with a situation which is hazardous if you have to cross the main street to get over to the bicycle path. But it would be much simpler just to turn onto the street and ride the mile or however far you're going to go, rather than having to cross a busy street to get over to the bicycle path, which in this case is the sidewalk. And the sidewalk, it gets big chunk holes in it, and they're constantly working on it, and there are youngsters with their dogs on it, and if you're out just to leisurely ride, it doesn't be no problem, but if you're in a hurry, it does. Another thing is that a bicyclist might be unaware of the existence of a bicycle path. One thing that might help this situation, section 128. It isn't stated in section 128 whether or not the provisions apply to persons riding on bicycle paths. It requires that vehicles approaching an intersection which must stop before entering it because of a stop sign have to give the right of way to the bicyclist. But up at the beginning of the section, it says bicyclists yield right of way at intersections. But it doesn't say whether if that applies when they're on a bicycle path or just when they're on the roadway. Now, if that applies to bicycle paths, for example, if you amended that view, bicyclists, whether on a bicycle path or on a roadway, this would help, because if you're on a bicycle path and a motorist stopping at a stop sign has to yield to you, this would make riding on a bicycle path much better for the bicyclist. And since the motorist has to stop anyway, it really wouldn't present a problem for him.
Other questions, Mr. Churchill? Senator Carson.
My understanding, Barbara, is that requires the bicyclist to stop. We check that. My concern is more of them suggested that perhaps one response would be to make the bicycle paths exclusive. Doesn't that just heighten the problem? In other words, we're exclusive for
I don't think you said that.
The language in 125.3, of course, requires the bicyclist to use the bike path exclusively rather than the roadway.
Mm-hmm.
And I was suggesting that requirement for exclusive use of the bicycle path by the bicyclist only pertain when, in fact, the bicyclist has exclusive use of that roadway, as contrasted with the jogger or the pedestrian.
That's the way I understood it. Let me see if I can say it's the same thing in a different way, and that is that this would apply, it presumes that we do designate bicycle paths as exclusively used for bicycles.
Which is not the present case.
Which is not the present case, but my concern is that heightens what I call apparent inequity.
it was useful. If the automobile drivers are paying for it, and now the pedestrians can't use the bicycle paths, if that's where we're coming out with it, then the bicycles seem to me to be getting a pretty good deal. That somebody else is paying for it and nobody else can use it. And
well,
it seems an extraordinarily beneficial program. That's the trouble.
Of course, I feel that bicyclists, especially commuting on bicycles, should be encouraged, because I think it is not just to the benefit of the bicyclist, it's to the benefit of the whole, it's to the public interest. I think it cuts down on the amount of energy consumption, it cuts down on air pollution, cuts down on the amount of land in cities that have to be given to the automobile. It's very good for your health-wise.
Mm-hmm. Well, for jogging and walking and bus driving, all the...
Well, I don't know. I'd have to certainly talk with some others before I said too much about this. But I think what I thought Senator Brown meant here was that there might be certain bicycle trails, particularly perhaps in cities, which are heavily used, or bike lanes. And those particular bike trails or lanes or paths or whatever we should call them would not be used by pedestrians and joggers. I don't know if it would be possible to write into the vehicle code certain kinds of bicycle trails, some that would be exclusively used by bicycles and others. There are cities, for example, I think Chicago has bike lanes, parts of the street which are designated for bicycle use. Well, obviously, those wouldn't be open to use by pedestrians.
Madam Chairman, I think Barbara and the previous witness brought up a good point. Salem is probably the best example of a bad bike path. The sidewalk is acting at ours, and there's one out on Portland Road where there's been a white stripe, and that somehow supposed to protect the bicyclists from the automobile. I think that section does need some help, but maybe John can do it. I think maybe requiring the agency to sign it, probably. And when it's posted, then it becomes the exclusive use, and not exclusive use of the bicyclists who can't use the road.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Burbidge,
that's stated at the request of the
questions are from the leader. Tim Carson.
It strikes me that that there is an alternative, and that is not to buy into the condominium, otherwise just not purchase condominium if you get crushed into the common element. The other thing that concerns me is that frequently, as I understand it, one of the basic differences of a condominium is in fact the medical use of the general area. In other words, as opposed to you own your apartment and then the common use of the hallways and the elevators and the lobby and so on. Would you propose that, you mentioned the swimming pool, that wouldn't apply to other common things such as hallways and lobbies and stairwells and
No, that certainly wasn't the intent of the legislation, and I didn't counsel that closely with legislative counsel and the language that they chose to use here, but the trust that I was after as a spokesman for constituents was those sorts of things that I described in the property that I own along with a mortgage company. It's not condominium, but at the time that we looked at that property, one of the selling points by the salesman was that we will have this swimming pool and you will be able to buy into the swimming pool club, but you don't, that's not a condition of buying into this area. Now, I'm talking apples and oranges, I know, but where I live is not considered condominium property. Later, when it was our option to buy into the swimming pool at a stated fee for the membership and so much to maintain it, that was our decision at a later time. It seemed to me that that sort of arrangement for the other facilities and niceties of the condominium and living could be on an optional basis, rather than as a buy-in, you have the entire package, or you don't get to live there.
Other questions from the building?
If you want to make that try at being more specific, would you like to?
I don't want to have another bill in it. I'd rather try the amendment that could be brought in, and maybe by bringing that restriction that had been burned to the Delta State.
Keith, The second paragraph, subparagraph of the subsection of section 2 speaks to what appears to be probably involved the same purchase, but buyer constituents, but it speaks to different elements. Perhaps if they do come in, or maybe you can enlighten me on, and I don't even know their names or the place involved, but what are you trying to get at there? It appears that they lease some common facilities and then they fail to do something, and as a result of failing to do something with their lease of common facilities, that they're closed and that they've done the million foreclosures. Is that what happened?
And then until the firm grew up all one summer, I don't
know. Well, you don't making people available to have another minute.
Thank you.
I apologize to the audience for skipping around on these bills, but we have some people with time problems. We'll try.
You have my bill yet, Betty, 240. Senate Bill 240 is right there. Okay.
Let's try 257 again and see if there's anybody here. Mr. Olson?
My name is Bob Olson. I'm appearing here on behalf of Senator Fred Hurd. He's a strong supporter of principal sponsor of Senate Bill 257. He was directed to the Senate due to a waiting news tour in Portland. He asked me to convey the following statement to you. As you will discover during this hearing, the science of polygraphy is most interesting in the potential problems involving polygraph exams and examiners demand legislative attention this session. Representing the consolidated efforts of numerous people, Senate Bill 257, which is before you, would license and regulate polygraph examiners and their trainees. Our primary thesis is that the public deserves to know that all polygraph examiners are properly trained and qualified. This need is especially great for the exams given which never reach the court system. 18 states currently have polygraph licensing legislation on the books, and many other states are now considering the enactment of such laws. At this time, Oregonians have little protection from unqualified polygraph examiners. In the past 2 or 3 years, there has been more change and growth in the field of polygraphy than during the rest of its entire history, which is approximately 80 years. This expansion has certainly been to the advantage of our justice system. It has also been to the advantage of the fast buck artists who can purchase a polygraph device one day and hang out their shingle the next day purporting to be a polygraph examiner. Polygraph units range in price from $2,000 to $4,000. A single polygraph examination will cost anywhere from $100 to $1,000, most examinations lasting between 1 and 3 hours. To illustrate that legitimate polygraph is also being done on a large scale, five officers of the Oregon State Police conducted 750 polygraph examinations last year alone. Although the results of these examinations are not yet admissible as evidence in court except under stipulation, their use at the preliminary levels of both criminal and civil cases is responsible for saving our legal and court systems a substantial amount of time and money. Effective rehabilitation programs can also be set up around polygraph examinations. Representatives of the district attorneys and criminal lawyers in our state, medical experts, law enforcement officers, public defenders, and Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge John Beatty are scheduled to give you more information on these topics than on the actual use of the polygraph. We have found that no worthwhile reason to oppose the concept of licensing and regulating polygraph examiners. Polygraphy is not an invasion of privacy because by its very nature it must be done on a voluntary basis. In terms of employment situations, the use of polygraphs is already restricted under Oregon law. Moreover, the Oregon State Police go so far as to suggest to an individual and not take a polygraph examination unless he or she admits, you know, knows that they are completely truthful and willing to be so. As a consequence of that, approximately 62% of the examinations by the state police are come out truthful. How does the polygraph work? The polygraph is essentially a combination of medical instruments. It monitors an individual's autonomic nervous system over which there is no voluntary control by at least recording visually, permanently, and simultaneously the cardiovascular pattern, the respiratory pattern, and the galvanic skin response. The patterns of other physiological changes may also be recorded. The theory behind the polygraph is that stimulus equals response. In other words, the stimulus would be a question, and the response represents a physiological reaction. Polygraphy is becoming extremely reliable through improved equipment and techniques. A recent survey indicates that, under ideal circumstances, that comprehensive polygraph examinations are 97% accurate. It should be remembered that the key to highly accurate polygraph results is competent and skilled examiners. Later in the hearing, Lloyd Riegel and Bruce Ladden of the Criminal Division State Police will be available to provide you with a more detailed explanation of the technical processes involved in a polygraph. After this hearing, you are invited down to the Senate Majority Office, Room 311, to observe a polygraph instrument if you wish to do so, and the members of the committee could certainly take an examination if they wanted to. For reasons already cited, Senate Bill 257 is important.
All hail.
Senate Bill 257 is important legislation. Several changes have been made in this current version, which makes the bill more viable. It is our belief that the five-member polygraph examiner board would be self-supporting to the collection of license and testing fees. And for the first year, $100 would be collected from approximately 23 or 24 examiners in the state. And the Board of Police Standards and Training remains ready to assist and cooperate with the polygraph examining board. And that's an accurate cost. Based on the fact that the polygraph examining board would be related to the Board of Police Standards and Training. In conclusion, one point should again be emphasized. The polygraph is here to stay, and the state has the obligation in the public interest to place minimum qualifications on polygraph examiners. We ask to give favorable consideration to Senate Bill 257. And I have some materials and the testimony here.
In what capacity are you appearing before the committee today?
Relating Senator Hurd's statement.
All right, now are you appearing as his administrative assistant or as an employee of the majority office?
As the assistant to Senator Hurd at his request.
Is this service available to every member of the majority?
I would imagine so if you got the permission of the majority leader.
Oh, are you a personal assistant to Senator Hurd?
You should probably ask him. I consider myself his administrative assistant, and for him, we help members of the Congress.
Oh, you're not speaking then on behalf of the Democratic majority, the Democratic caucus, or the majority of the Democratic senators?
Senator Cook, as I said in my first line of testimony, that I was appearing on behalf of Senator Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Judge Beebe?
Madam Chairman and the gentleman of the committee, my name is John Beebe, 2958 Southwest Dodge Road, Portland. I'm appearing here is frequently not representing anybody other than myself, and of course my own experiences. I'm appearing on behalf of this bill, holographic, which I think is important legislation. Holographic examination is used in connection with my court in essentially three ways. First, holographic examination appears frequently by stipulation of the defense office as evidence in criminal trials. Secondly, on a number of occasions, I have employed possibility of holographic examination and holographic examination as an aid in sentencing. In those instances in which a conviction has resulted, either by jury verdict or in which I have convicted a defendant, in each case, the prior fact finding beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty, in which the defendant still maintains total innocence in a pre-sentence investigation following trial. It's fairly obvious that it's impossible to devise any probationary program, any remedial program for somebody who doubtfully maintains that they had nothing to do with a particular offense which they've been convicted. In those instances, I think almost without exception, offered defense counsel at that stage an opportunity for polygraphic examination. Two or three instances, been accepted, and the report of polygraphic examination clearly set shown. In all other instances, the defendant has refused polygraphic examination.
Deception was shown, did you guess?
So that it operates in that sense as the safety valve at the tail end of the judicial process. The question may arise, what happens after you've had a jury verdict? No problem with the court. The court, until a judgment is signed, retains jurisdiction. Had a jury verdict, what happens if somebody's been convicted by a jury and they show no deception on polygraphic examination? Well, that problem hasn't arisen yet. When it does, I'm sure there'll be some way of solving that problem. I think it may require sort of going back to the drawing board at that point, but it still remains a valuable safety valve. Third instance that I use it is in connection with attempting probationary controls over defendants whose past criminal record and type of criminal activity indicates that if it were not for additional controls, it would be absolutely essential to sentence them to a long period of incarceration. Typical certain type of repetitive burglars, repetitive heroin addicts, people whose public safety requires that you maintain a substantial amount of control over them. On an experimental program with an advisory committee, I sentenced now some 31 people to, by stipulation, to a regular polygraphic examination every 90 days or at such extended period as the court may order. We've been doing this for about a little over a year and a half. And I have now some 31 people who have been tried out on that stipulation. Nine of them have been revoked. So far, none of them have been revoked because deception being shown in their examination on specific offenses. Usually what happens is that they
failed to show up to the examination or skip out. But there are still a substantial number of these people who are successfully, for the first time in many years, remaining free of any criminal activity and who are being handled under in conjunction with probation officers in an effort to change their behavior in this respect. And these are all people who otherwise would be in OCI or in the penitentiary. Now, to conclude, this will only work, and everyone on the advisory committee, I have many of whom are going to testify here in support of this bill. This is the advisory committee I have in my own court for this experimental program that we're running. This only works if you have a polygraphic examiner who are highly skilled and in whom both the defense bar and the court and the district attorney's office have confidence, because if the interpretation aspect of this is important, and therefore I think that it's very desirable that polygraphic examination be conducted only by people whose integrity is assured, whose training is proper, satisfies all of the needs of the particular skills are necessary. I think the bill will accomplish this. I would make one suggestion. The board as it is set up appears to me, a five-man board, to be essentially a police agency board. And I would think it advisable that since all elements of the criminal justice system have an interest in this, as well as the public, of course, is very serious interest in it, I would think it advisable to alter the composition of the board. And I would suggest that you consider adding a representative of the Metropolitan, a lawyer from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office staff as a member. I would also suggest adding one member from the defense bar, someone with experience in the defense of criminal cases. I don't think in any way inhibits the functioning of that board. I think it would give it a broader approach and strengthen the bill.
Madam Chairman, Judge Beatty, do you know any bad polygraph operators?
No, I don't know any bad polygraph operators, but I should say that I would not be a reliable person for to answer that question, because the only ones I have used, directly or indirectly, have been ones in which both the defense counsel and the district attorney's office agree are good ones.
Well, can you tell me what part of this bill then you think will protect and upgrade polygraph operators?
Well, I am advised by some defense counsel that there are polygraph operators. They do not think they're able. I've been advised by other operators that they think there are some people that they don't think are adequately trained.
And I think this bill will get rid of those people.
Well, I don't know whether it'll get rid of them, but it will certainly ensure that if people come into the field, they'll be trained. And I only see a very small number of these people. I see the ones who demonstrated competence, because people agree that they are competent.
On page 5 of the bill, Slide 13 and 14. Do you believe that the board ought to have the responsibility to determine every year such abstract, questionable things as honesty, truthfulness, integrity, and good moral character? As a judge, would you want to give a board that kind of broad authority?
The Board of Bar Examiners has some such language, such supervision.
Well, I can understand why the Board of Bar Examiners should have, but I'm talking about
I think those judgments have to be made with respect to polygraph operators.
because their personal integrity is really a key to it.
Well, do you think that kind of language will be interpreted by the board as a rule to these people? Annually they come up and must be tested on these kinds of questions?
Well, I think subparagraph 3 would be interpreted as an advisory as far as the board is concerned, that they are to pay attention to people's reputation for integrity, and they are to be alert that they are persons who ought to be like the burden of refusing somebody would have to be litigated. And obviously that kind of a standard would be difficult to maintain, but I think it has some weight there as a guideline of the board.
Any other questions or questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Dennis Howell?
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. My name is Des Connell. I'm a private attorney in Portland, and I'm here on my own in support of Senate Bill 257. I realize there's a certain amount of hesitancy on the part of government to get involved with polygraphs because the concept that they delve into the issue of truth. We've had some restrictive legislation already because of that. On the other hand, I think it's vitally important on some occasions that we have qualified people in this field, especially in the criminal justice system. When you're in the decision-making process and you really don't know what the truth is, sometimes it's vitally important to be able to turn to some resource to assist you in that judgment. The criminal law is particularly difficult in this area in that someone is normally saying that someone else is lying, both as a prosecutor and as a private attorney. I turn to this device on many occasions. I'm not going to speak to the equipment itself. I'm not qualified to do so. I do, though, speak to the issue of the integrity of the operator, because therein lies the key to the system. The judgments that are made are really rather awesome. I, as a defense attorney, or as a prosecutor, know when I turn to a polygraph operator, that I'm probably making a final judgment regarding that man, the disposition of that man's case. As a practical matter, the police will clear or charge based on polygraph. As a practical matter, the district attorney will indict or not indict based on polygraph. A defense attorney, as a practical matter, may well not go to trial based on polygraph. Now, the machine, as I understand it, is relatively accurate. Its interpretation is critical. Judge Beatty said he's never yet run into a situation where someone was polygraphed after judgment and found to be non-deceptive. I've had that happen. Remember a young man who was charged with robbery and duly convicted 7 years ago, sentenced 5 years. Judge Ross Court, we polygraphed him afterwards based on some information which we received. He was non-deceptive. I moved to that judgment. We do those things, and I realized that to that degree on polygraph in the past year. It so happens that I had full faith in the operator. I've used him for many, many years on many occasions. He's not a local man, unfortunately, but one in whom I have great faith and trust. I, on the other hand, have, after indictment, I can recall, in a very major murder case, when defense counsel asked that I do so, caused all the defendants to be polygraphed, with the understanding that if they cleared the polygraph, in a circumstantial case, you must have put down another decade, dismissed. In that particular case, as I recall it, all three show deception. We proceeded to trial. Many times, although the district attorney in Multnomah County currently has a little different policy, if defense counsel present a polygraph by a properly trained and qualified operator, many district attorneys will accept that.
Isn't Haas accepting that now?
Only by stipulation. I don't think there should be any requirement that both the district attorney and defense attorney agree that the results will be admitted into evidence regardless. I think that's an idiotic policy. As a defense attorney, I like full freedom of operation. And if I want my man polygraphed, I want him polygraphed. It's nobody's business what he says until we're all through. And if we think the district attorney needs it, he'll have it.
So are you saying then that you think, and I know this is the law, that you should be able to have the accused polygraphed, but still be able to assert his innocence without having the results brought in? And you're saying the present DA requires that there be admissible?
Well, Harold's present policy is that if both parties agree, and apparently if the evidence will be admitted based on stipulation, or the result would be admitted evidence, you'll normally agree to be bound by the result of polygraph. I just think that that's a policy question, or has nothing to do with this bill. I use the polygraph extensively now.
Are you representing a lot of defendants now?
Several. Yeah. Recently, I had a kid charged with murder in Multnomah County, and we were satisfied that he was innocent of murder. We thought he was guilty of burglary. So we had him polygraphed again by the same man that I've used for so many years on four critical questions. He was non-deceptive. He was truth-telling. He hadn't pulled the trigger. He didn't know that other kid had a gun, that sort of thing. That, of course, gave rise to a full affirmative defense. I caused that examination to be made independently. I gave it to the trial deputy and said, here, the kid's innocent of murder. We'll plead for burglary. And the trial deputy, being young and aggressive as I've never been,
and you've never been young.
I've never been aggressive. My hair is getting ready. Okay. Refused to accept the result. Well, the jury did accept the concept. The kid was not guilty of murder, he was guilty of burglary, as he said. The equipment has real validity, generally, if it's properly operated. And it can be used many, many ways in the system. I'm very concerned about the quality of the operator. This has always been my concern. I think Dr. Abrams will be along in a moment to talk to you about it, but and I think he will also say that the equipment is relatively accurate, and it's the integrity of the operator. It's the honesty of the operator. It's the objectivity of the operator to which we look for results. I, as a practical matter, have always restricted
the utilization of polygraph operators to a relatively small group of people, simply because I have full faith in those people. I think the fact is that when you're in the decision-making process, in a circumstantial situation, you really don't know what the answer is, you're going to look to some outside objective source for judgment, to assist you in judgment-making. As a practical matter, people will turn to the polygraph because it's here and it has a reputation for being relatively accurate. So it's here, it's being used on a day-to-day basis. I think we have a real obligation to ourselves and to the bar and to the public to ensure that the operators are regulated. Minimum standards are set and the qualifications are cranked into our local system. I just talked to Stan Abrams a moment ago. He indicated he's technically qualified. I am not. He felt that the standards which are set forth in this proposed bill are adequate.
Well, I was going to ask Dez the same question that Senator Smith asked Judge Beatty. Do you think this bill will move substantially in the direction of improving the caliber of polygraph operators?
Yeah, I think it will. I think it will assure that we have a floor, and in the future we should, of course, attempt to upgrade.
It doesn't grandfather
in. I think there's a grandfather in. It's a practical matter. You're going to grandfather in, I suppose, most of the local operators, which then has a review on a yearly basis.
Now, will they, the ones that are grandfathered in, will they have to be reviewed annually?
It appears to me, as I read the bill, that that's the intent.
I understand under the, under the Oregon Nurse Practice Act, they have to have so much experience. Have we brought in any licensing bills in the past? Well, we have with TV technicians. They've had to pass the test. We didn't grandfather those in, at least not initially.
No.
Quite. They were later grandfathered in, didn't they?
For
1 year only. What would you think if we were to amend this to say that within, say, 2 years or some such thing, that the polygraph operator has to pass the same test as all the new ones pass?
Well,
the qualifications are set forth. I have very strong feelings about this. I think it should be a very high standard. And I think that everyone should meet it. That's my own personal judgment. And I think you should have a broader base on the board. It's police-oriented now. The defense bar at this time has very few options available to it when it comes to the question of polygraph. The defense bar must now go to a police-trained operative, that's practical matter, except for Stan Abrams in Portland. Or go out of state.
Who is this person that you have such a high regard for, and where does he come from?
George Harmon is the man I have used for many years. He's an operator in San Francisco from the Reed School. He's been there many years. I used him both as VA and as a private practitioner. Man of high integrity.
Well, does your last comment here concern me? Because I understand where you're coming from, and you say that along with Senator Smith's concern, you have a three or four small group of people in whom you have trust. If we have a grandfather, let's assume for the moment that the 23 operatives that are polygraph examiners all are either grandfathered in or passed the test, you probably would keep the same feeling about polygraph examiners you have now. You wouldn't willy-nilly just say that guy's got a certificate, therefore I'll use him. So you're really saying is that you have to build a group of trust and understanding and belief in the integrity, and don't let me mislead you, but I wonder how passing the exam will help you in your business. You'll stay with
it. It won't help me personally because I know where I'm going all the time.
Right.
As long as that man's alive, I'll use him. If something happens to him, I would use Stan Abrams in Portland because Stan is non-police in background and he's highly qualified. I know the field well. But I got a call last week from a lawyer somewhere out of the metropolitan area, and he said, Des, who can you go to
I've got a kid charged with murder. And he says he's anything else. Who's a good polygraph officer? Well, he doesn't know. He calls me. In time, if we set a basic standard, we're going to improve the caliber of the officers. This is going to be known. Oh, now, another thing, too. Me, I'm very conservative about this polygraph thing. I think if you would talk to the people who are in the business, they will tell you that most of the people in Oregon are fully qualified. So don't misunderstand.
No, I understand. No, that's, I think, the point that I'm focusing on is that there is a bond beyond merely licensing,
although yes,
being, quote, the special qualification.
Right. It's the attorney-client relationship. It's the doctor-patient relationship. You know, you have faith and trust for these people.
Well, that brings me to a question that is a little aside from this, and that goes to the question, do you attend the examination yourself when it's been conducted?
No, I normally don't. In fact, most polygraph operators prefer that after you go through the initial interview with the operator and the test questions are determined, that you then retire to another area so that he and the person being tested are there by themselves. There's a permit tape always made, and everything is recorded.
Permanent audio tape as well as the...
There's a permanent paper tape, paper graph, which is always made, depending on the machine that you use, 3 or 4 needle traces are on that. And most operators also audio tape with the comparison.
So there'd be no opportunity to be questioned to get mismatched.
That's right. Right. Very important. Very important. Very delicate thing. Question. Very delicate.
This on the technician, but also on the question, the so-called teacher.
Yeah.
I had a case recently who invested not for defense purposes, but to talk with one of the deputy district attorneys out there, in which he admitted, as he put it, that he had bounced the guy up and down, but meaning mentally, not physically anyway, before he took the polygraph exam. Would that kind of experience have an effect upon the results of the polygraph?
Dan Evans could answer that question for you. I don't
I presume the training and that sort of thing that these people that all of those kinds of situations would be well aware of how to evaluate what had happened to the person who's prior to taking the exam.
Yeah, they will normally go through a pre-test interview and qualify the person for the equipment. Some people won't respond, you know.
Well, now let me ask what the
sodium amytal.
Yeah. How often is that used and by whom, and is this to verify the polygraph? And
I only know
who administers that.
I only know of one major case in Oregon where amytal was used. Dr. Suco at the Oregon State Hospital used sodium amytal on Nikki Essex in the Peyton Allen case many years ago. That was independent of polygraphing, and that was done voluntarily by the witness. She had a conversion reaction, hysterical amnesia. Dr. Suco, at the hospital, in a hospital environment, worked her through that conversion reaction and eliminated the blockage. She was never polygraphed. Well, she was polygraphed, yes. She was polygraphed at the same time the three defendants were polygraphed in that case, along with another witness, Mrs. Jorgensen, if I recall. The polygraph results were that she believed that what she was telling was truth. But there's no correlation between the amytal there and the polygraph. If you ever, in some size night, soon inserted a false or defective memory, then the polygraph indicates that you're truth-telling. later, I assume, but again, Dr. Abrams can talk to that issue. Amitol is not used along with Polygraph, to my knowledge.
But it's used to verify, isn't it?
You could. You could verify by Amitol, I suppose, I think.
Or to challenge.
I think by and large, Polygraph is much more accurate than I just don't know.
Thank you. Don Vernon.
Members of the board, my name is Don Barnes. I'm a staff attorney with the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. I'm here in support of Senate Bill Number 257 personally, and I suppose as one who is a de facto representative of the largest consumer, so to speak, of polygraph examination. Our office uses this instrument and the technique very extensively in handling criminal cases. We have found in certain kinds of cases it's been an invaluable tool. For example, the kinds of cases in which there are no victims or in which victims are unable to testify. Child abuse cases, sodomy on small children, that sort of thing. It's been my personal experience that I've had five cases I can think of, all major felonies, dismissed on the basis of polygraph examination conducted by the state police. This has been informally through deputy district attorneys who do dismiss these cases based on their confidence in the examination and in the examiner. Had other situations personally in which the same deputies have refused to accept the results of other examiners because they did not know them personally. I think one of the reasons for one of the necessities of having such a bill is to establish a base level which would encourage prosecuting officers to accept polygraphs from people they don't know personally, but do know have been subject to some licensing requirement, have been examined, that their abilities have been demonstrated to an effective board. Like one other very important purpose of a board like this is for periodic referral of an examiner who may be making mistakes or may be making apparent mistakes and who might have grown perhaps lax in the administration of his test. As things stand now, there is no such corrective device. This bill, however, provides for relicensing or revocation of a license based on demonstrated inability or defective technique.
Where this bill corrects the problem of a polygraph operator who becomes lax in his work.
There is a provision that the board may license or revoke licenses of examiners based on a number of criteria.
Yeah, that's
oh, 15. Right, page 6, section 17. Excuse me.
To help you answer my question, section 15 is the only part of the bill that I see that sets up any criteria for licensing and relicensing, as it is for others.
Section 21 centers the top of page 8. The board may refuse to issue or may revoke or suspend the license of any person as a polygraph examiner or trainee if it finds that the person. Then going down, I think, number seven, has demonstrated any inability or incompetency to carry out the duties of a polygraph examiner. I think it's a very important recourse or mechanism to, if not weed people out, at least bring them back up to standard.
How would you prove that?
By submitting the chart, the results, the questions asked to an examiner, to another examiner, for example, and if you got an opinion from him that there was in fact improper technique employed, by submitting the entire package, so to speak, the chart, the questions, the tape, if any, to the board and ask that they consider whatever steps are indicated.
What if there's no tape? What if you're just dealing with the paper and the questions, and that's about all you've got, isn't it?
There's always a chart, and the questions, if improperly prepared, or if, for example, are a succession of critical questions, could in and of themselves constitute an improperly given test. I'm sure that the experts could address themselves better to that.
Mr. Barnes, in section 26, there's a requirement that only three channels, the cardiovascular and respiratory, and the galvanic skin response. Now, there are, of course, other channels or other indicia that can be recorded, such as upper leg muscle flexion and chest wall expansion. Do you find any importance in those other physiological changes that might require that a fourth tooth channel be added as a mandatory requirement of testing?
Senator, I don't think I can give you a reasonable answer because I'm not an expert in use. I'm only an attorney who uses the examiners, so to speak, and their technique.
Good question. Thank you, sir. Mr. Burt,
Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Bob Hamilton, Chief Criminal Deputy Chief. Mr. Gortman.
I didn't think that looked like Gary Gortman.
I wanted to speak in support of Senate Bill 257, and my initial comment was to you to indicate the courage of the sponsors of this bill to ask anyone from the Marion County District Attorney's Office to appear here in support of it, specifically Mr. Gortman.
I have high regards for Mr.
Gortman. Thank you, sir. It's also very difficult for me to stand in for him with his reputation. It's also difficult to follow previous witnesses of the caliber that have appeared before you and add anything to what they've said, other than to reiterate to you that important decisions are being made daily, very, very important decisions by prosecutors and by defense counsel and by judges, based solely on the results of polygraph examination. I am a lying prosecuting attorney at this time, and I've made what I think are important decisions based solely upon polygraph examination. We do in Marion County use it basically in two regards, as in most counties, in the investigation of criminal offenses, and this mainly involves with witnesses at the time of the investigation of certain offenses. And an interesting situation evolved, not by design in Marion County, after the initiation of criminal charges. What in essence began to happen was we get into a situation where we have a tough decision. We have the usual decision a prosecutor has to make based upon the available evidence. The question would come up, would we give a polygraph examination? We started doing that, and we started doing it quite a bit. The next step that we took in Marion County was, after the case had been initiated, we began requiring, as a condition to our offer for a polygraph examination, that the defendant and his attorney enter into a stipulation as to the admissibility of the results and to the qualification of the operator. And we use exclusively operators from the Oregon State Police. Based upon those stipulations, it was agreed that in the result of a favorable polygraph examination, the charges were dismissed if that was the issue, and if not, they'd go to trial, but we could use the evidence. And we never got to the point as to whether they could then go on and get their own examiner, and we'd end up in a court fight as to the qualifications of the examiner. that's the next step as far as my evaluation is concerned, and that's one of the reasons we're in support of this bill, so that qualified people are coming into court, the qualified people are giving the information upon which decisions are made.
What's your response to Des Connell's implied implicit criticism of this technique, as apparently is also being used in the Multnomah County DA's office?
That we require the stipulation? Well, we, as a general pattern, we do. We don't always. And sometimes it depends upon the general importance of the case, the degree of evidence we have. I'd have to be candid to say that. If I have a situation where I have evidence I feel quite strongly about, I think that we can be successful in court. I think we're giving up a lot from a prosecutor's standpoint to offer a polygraph examination if we don't have anything to gain out of it.
What if it's, as I understood his recommendation, that it could be done without prejudice, then you examine the results and then decide after examining the results whether it seems meritorious or not. Do you think there's anything really wrong with that?
No, not necessarily. No. It's been a, and I don't have any statistics, and I'm not really prepared on the details of this bill other than to reiterate our support. But we have found it's a tremendous, tremendous aid to case volume and case control and to move cases along through the criminal justice system. I would imagine we run 3 or 4 polygraph examinations a week by use of state police. And part of the advantage we have is that we do have 2 qualified examiners in state police headquarters here in Salem, which we use. Other than that, and I haven't talked with specifically with other current prosecutors, but I've never heard anyone say anything that would go against the spirit and the intent and the need to pass legislation at this time.
Well, you heard Judge Smith's question of Judge Beatty. Do you feel that this bill will improve the quality of the person in the business?
I don't think it will improve the quality of the person in the business today. I think the potential people that are going to come into the business is what we're concerned about. I'm not concerned about anyone in the business.
If this bill passed, Bob, would it encourage you to use people other than state police, polygraph examiners?
I think so, because at the present time, if I'm going to have a polygraph examination, then I'm going to do like everyone else is. I'm going to have someone run it that I know. Or if someone proposes someone to me, by what standard do I judge that person? I can turn and ask the guy that I have run mine and say, hey, is so-and-so qualified? But that's about it right now.
Thank you. Dr. Abrams? I'm Dr. Stanley Abrams. I'm at the Criminity Clinic in Portland. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm also a polygraphist of rather recent origin. I might add, I've done a lot of research.
What's your background again, doctor?
I'm a clinical psychologist, PhD, and took training in polygraphy in 1971, I think, and have done, to a large extent, research, clinics, but I've done a lot of criminal cases as well, a very few times. And I also have traveled a bit recently to various states and have laid foundations in polygraph and had the opportunity of going over many of the results of polygraphy in various states, which I'm afraid is a sometimes sad experience. And this is one reason why we should certainly pass this bill. We're very certain that we could take the standards in this case.
Do you know how many states do have
approximately 18 more around the process. There were a lot of questions that Mr. Connolly was good enough to talk in my direction, and perhaps you can re-ask them. There's one area that I felt I could cover. That's the area I've done most of my research in, and that's validity of the polygraph. I think it's very pertinent to this particular bill. All of the research findings have essentially indicated that 98% accuracy has been attained. I might add this is very impressive when you consider my colleagues in psychology and psychiatry, where we have an accuracy level of, or validity level of, approximately 54%, and that's a gross diagnostic category. That's terrible, but that's the way it is. This is highly valid. However, three conditions must apply. One is that the instrument itself must be in good condition. Secondly, that it should have at least, if not more, than three sensors, three measures. In the bill it says at least three measures, three sensors to evaluate the individual, by the way. And the reason for this is there are a good many people in the country calling themselves polygraphists who use simply a galvanic skin response instrument, which is just one measure, and the accuracy is questionable. So this is one reason the bill states three sensors at least. The second aspect is the subject should be in good emotional and physical condition, reasonably good. Obviously, if he's heavily drugged or if he's in pain or has any major medical or psychiatric conditions, the test could be his own merit.
Did you hear that person that came to Robert's house? I asked I asked Ms. Connell about the person I encountered, and he admitted that he, quote, had bounced the guy up and down, meaning mentally, not physically, but that he had questioned him himself. And said he was a good questioner and he knew he could tell when they were lying and telling the truth and this sort of thing. So he had suggested this person to that experience just prior to taking the polygraph.
Yeah, there should never be any kind of interrogation prior to the testing itself, because that could disrupt the entire polygraph situation. For example, if it sets off anger, then you don't know what kind of results you're going to get. This is one thing that a good examiner would avoid completely. Now, there's no question that certain techniques can be used which make it a much more effective examination. Bouncing around is a vague term, but if you're talking about emphasizing to the individual the accuracy of the polygraph, and that if you're telling the truth, you don't have a worry in the world. If you're lying, however, it's a very different situation. I think that's very appropriate. One method we do use, I think it's mentioned briefly, is to have the individual write a number between 20 and 25, and then secrete it someplace in this person. And this isn't a parlor game. This is to demonstrate to the person how effective the technique is. And then you ask them in the test itself to say no each time you ask if they chose that number, including the number they chose. And you look at it and tell them they chose the 22, and they're very impressed, presumably. Now, if they're innocent of the crime, they should relax considerably and now feel quite secure that the examiner won't find them deceptive when in fact they're not. Obviously, for the person who is going to be deceptive, it's kind of frightening experience. Now, this reinforces the effectiveness of the technique, but moreover, it gives you some idea of what their particular lie pattern looks like, because each individual varies. So their response might be a high blood pressure reaction, others it might be increased heart rate, respiration change, CFR change, things of this sort. So this is part of the technique. I wouldn't call it bouncing around. Anything that implies bouncing around is going to invalidate the test result. Might be very concerning. I've met most of the examiners in this state, and they all seem quite tough. It's just like my field in psychology or psychiatry. It's also hard to evaluate someone's work when you don't know what they're doing the best yourself. But I suspect they're quite good. When I've seen results outside of the state, I feel there's a very strong need for quality control. And as a member of the American Polygraph Association, we're working in this direction. We would hope that this bill would start by eliminating any people who aren't qualified who are going to be coming into the state. Now, there will be more coming in because the use of polygraphs is increasing considerably. So we certainly want to deal with that. But this is just our first step. We also want to be able to deal with those within the state now who perhaps need additional training and additional work, but that will be in the future. There may even be something in which we come up with something akin to the diplomas that you have in psychology, where we find those who are particular experts that we might refer to the court so they can choose from among these people. As it is now, I think attorneys use those who they're accustomed to using and are satisfied with their results, when in all probability they could probably use any of the roughly 23 examiners in the state. The third aspect, insofar as validity is concerned, is the obvious, that's the examiner himself. Now, the polygraph is an instrument just like a stethoscope or an electrocardiograph. It relies very much, the results rely very much on the interpretation of the examiner. And so we want someone who's trained, who's experienced, and who's competent. And again, the major purpose of this bill then is the protection of the public. So I think the polygraph bill as it reads now will accomplish that as a starting point. I think there are more things that will be needed in the future. But I think this is the beginning before we get a lot of additional people in, as they've had in California. So they make passing of such a bill much more difficult. But many more people have reason to be grandfathered in, and their abilities are questionable.
How did you happen to get into this field late in life, so to speak?
Oh, thanks a lot.
Did you already get that gun on there? strictly through research, I became very interested in it and attempted various approaches to determine how the polygraph examiner could be misled through various techniques like hypnosis and such, and became interested enough to take the course and finally decide that doing actual criminal investigations is very expensive, so I devote some time to that for time.
Is hypnosis an aid to the polygraph, or is it used with it at all?
No. There have been some attempts by people to mislead the examiner by hypnosis, but I wouldn't be concerned about that. There incidentally was some question about the use of quote truth theorem, and the general feeling is that's not very valid. These attempts at this and found that people can lie very effectively under truth theorem, under hypnosis, and polygraph is still way up there as far as I can say.
Dr. Abrams, have you encountered any case or cases where a force sensor measuring a force physiological reaction has been determinative in ascertaining whether or not the subject is being detected?
Well, there has been a good deal of research on various sensors, and in the end, the result is that the most effective ones are still those that we're using. I'm sure in the future additional ones will be forthcoming, but right now these are the best. In laboratory research, where they have very sophisticated equipment, they don't get as good, they don't get as high validity as we do. It's probably not so much a matter of the equipment, but rather the fact that the laboratory subject has little to lose in the lie. But still, more sophisticated equipment has been used, and it isn't as effective as what we have now. Further research is being done. I'm sure we'll have additional
sensor.
I gather the cardiovascular pattern sensor is indicating both speed and blood pressure.
That's correct.
Madam Chairman. Being accused of a serious crime, I think it's just obviously quite an emotional thing. How do you overcome that common condition when you should apologize?
That's probably the question asked the most frequently and the best question, in that anyone taking a test accused of murdering someone is going to have a very high reaction, a very large reaction to that question, whether they're being honest or deceptive. We have a series of controls that we utilize. One of which is called the guilt complex question, and that's where you accuse the person of committing a very similar crime, one that you couldn't possibly have committed, but make it sound very real. If he responds just as highly on that question, you know this is someone you simply can't test, because he'll react to any question if there's a threat. The second question type is called a control question, and this is ascertained in the pre-test interview, where you question them to determine such things as, now it's always related to the crime. Have you ever done anything illegal? Have you ever committed a crime? Have you ever, if it were a sexual question, have you ever thought of raping a woman? Things of this sort. Again, you stick to the general area in which the individual is being tested. Okay, when you find that the individual denies some of these that are rather obvious that he is lying, and then you can use this as a control question. I don't know if I've made myself clear, but I think if I asked all of you if you ever committed a crime and not been caught, the answer I would assume would be yes, if you permit. But some people, believe it or not, say no. And you collect a series of these no answer questions, and now these are assumed lies. Now, then you point out to them, now these questions are as important as the questions you raise with your speech of, and that it says something about your character. And we don't want you lying on you, so you have to tell the truth. So in other words, you build up the value of these particular questions. And to the point that, one, if the person is honest in relation to the crimes accused of, he's now very concerned about the fact that he's lying on the control question, because this might give the implication that he'll be lying on the other questions as well. And the result of this is, and research has demonstrated it consistently, that a person who is honest regarding the crime will have a certainly response to those relevant questions, but a much larger response to the control question, because he has a lot to lose. He knows he's lying, and he's afraid that on this one he might be connected with the crime because he's detected on it. In contrast to this, the guilty person is lying to both, but his concern is much greater to the relevant question than the fact that he committed a shoplifting offense 3 years ago. So his response will be much greater to the relevant. And this has been demonstrated particularly for research that for us to be sure that we can come up with a pretty definite conclusion on that.
For the question, Dr. Thank you, Dr. Nathan. Lieutenant Rival?
Chairman, in order to try to cut down on time, I have some information I've compiled here for you to know. My name is Lloyd Regal. I'm a lieutenant in the Department of State Police. I'm also a polygraph examiner. I don't tend to be well qualified as some of the people that have spoken before you. However, I would like to make some points regarding the polygraph in support of our bill 257. Mostly, I will try to answer some of the questions that I have heard during of the other witnesses.
What is your name again?
Riegel, R-I-E-G-E-L. Of the 23 examiners we have in this state at the present time, of which there's a list in the front of the brochure, I have no question of any of those 23 examiners. Without exception, all of them have passed and have attended and graduated from a polygraph school, with the exception of one gentleman who is a highly qualified man, has been trained over the period of years and has many years of experience, and I have no question as to his qualifications. So the thing that I am worried about is the other examiners that may come in. Now, if you will notice in your material I gave you that there was approximately 2,500 examinations conducted in the state of Oregon last year. 1,256 of those were in some form of illegal channel. They were either after complaints or indictments. They were represented by attorneys. They went into the court procedures. And on those cases, I can't say I don't worry about them, but I worry less about those people because they are represented by counsel, and the counsel has a chance to make some study into who is going to do the examination. The people that I worry more about are the 1,218 people who are screened as possible suspects in the case, people that are brought in at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning by the investigating officer to be screened. They have not been represented by counsel. They do not enter into the court. And I would like to be assured in my mind that those 1,218 people are receiving the very best that they can receive from a polygraph examiner. I don't want them to have any situations where they are given improper polygraph examinations, given examinations, instruments that are not qualified, that do not meet the qualifications of our bill, or that they have been mistreated or not properly advised before taking the examination. Mm-hmm. There's also 45 examinations, probation examinations. This is a program that Judge Beatty spoke of that I have worked with Judge Beatty over the last year quite intensely. I'm quite proud of the bill or the program. I think we have done a very good job considering the class of people that we've had to work with. It might also be noted that many attorneys argue against the bill because they say it is a means by which you're going to get my man in, find him deceptive, and get a confession from him. Our statistics do not prove that to be at all deceptive. There have been 35% of the people are found deceptive, 62% of them are found to be truthful, and 3% are found to be inconclusive. Also in the courts of Multnomah County within the last 2 years, I have had two incidents of where people were on the stand or in the courtroom at the time being tried for murder on situations where the chief witness had been given immunity. And in two cases, I found that the chief witness was the person who was the one who was guilty of the crime, and the person being tried was not guilty of the crime and had to stop the trial. Now, I think that these are the type of things that polygraph can do for us. They are also becoming more prevalent that we're examining witnesses specifically in the heavier cases, the greater cases.
How, Madam Chairman, how did you find that out?
In this particular case, the court requested that certain witnesses be given examinations before they took the witness stand, and in this particular situation, I found that the two witnesses who were the key witnesses in this case had been lying in what they had told the prosecuting officers and the investigating officers, and they themselves were actually the ones that had committed the murder to the person being tried.
They'd been given immunity before this?
Yeah.
So then they were never charged with the commission?
I can't answer that. I think there was some conditions made that they were in some way. I don't know. That went into a different city. I don't know. Now, the other thing that I have found was mentioned someplace, I think Senator Cook brought up about the purpose of people being given examinations without a stipulation situation. I do many examinations every month that are ordered by the court. Mr. Don Barnes, who spoke to you from the public defender's office, has an order from the court, ex parte order, where I examine people, or my assistant, Mr. Latin, examines people, and the results of the examination are known only to the defense attorney. From that basis, they can then decide whether or not they, what procedures they want to follow after that. We have also found that after deception has been found in examination, that 81% of the people that are found deceptive plead guilty after the trial, after this examination is over. We have a court appearance of about 5% of the total number of examinations that we do. The polygraph examinations are increasing quite rapidly. We're all experiencing quite an increase. I have talked to most of the examiners in the state. I'm the president of the Northwest Polygraph Examiners Association. I had an opportunity to phone them just last week to get statistics, and a good many of the examiners are in the courtroom this morning, or in the room here this morning, in support of the bill. Now, two or three other points I noticed here, and I will shut up and let you ask what you want. One of the points is, well, something was brought up about, I believe you just brought up about, what would the bill do for us on the case? Okay, all right. I thought they referred to you.
So they did. That's our standard story.
I'm in a county.
Okay. That's right. Anyway, they brought up as to what are we going to use to try to upgrade. Number one, our examination will be based upon the examination that has been brought up by the American Polygraph Association, which is the association that we sort of lean to, all other associations sort of lean to, that American Polygraph Association as our standard. They have developed an examination, and our examination will be somewhat along that line. We will also add other conditions to it, the presentation of charts and other material that the board will have to examine. However, we do feel that if the examiner is qualified and can pass that examination, then he is still in his competency as to be an examiner. There was also a question brought up, I believe, Senator Brown, to the just the three channels. The bill does not limit to other any other channels if there are other channels available, and there will be other channels that are being worked upon. Such as the papismal graph and various other channels that are being worked upon that are not being included at this time and have not really established their accuracy to the degree that all instruments are included. But if an instrument does have them, or when and if the instrument, the end dice is brought into approved standards, why then it can be added and is not held out by our bill. And we're very welcome for everything that we can get additional, but we at least would like the three channels, because there are many instruments, as mentioned. Some are using just the one, the galvanic skin response. There are several using two, the pneumomyocardial and not the galvanic skin response. I believe every instrument that I know of in the state now has at least three and possibly four channels, and we would like for at least three. Now, one of the other reasons I would like to see the bill introduced, as I say, I'm not a question of any examiners that we have in the state at the present time, but as the numbers increase, as you can see, there's going to be, like anything else, people that are going to float in and take advantage of the bills, or take advantage of the prosperity if they can. If a man comes in and he is a qualified examiner, there are provisions made within the bill for a qualified examiner to come into state and set up as an examiner. However, if he's not a qualified examiner, I don't think we would like to have him in our state, and I'm sure that we feel better of our defendants in cases, or people that are accused in cases, that we would like to see that they do have the very best that we can possibly give.
You made a selection of what? Like, I think you said there's 22 people, and then you had the utmost confidence. Did you leave any names off that you felt were free?
There are two examiners that I understand in the state at the present time that I know very little about. One only came to my attention Friday. I've had no opportunity to check on him. In fact, I don't even know his entire complete name. They say his name is Kennedy. He works for the Jackson County Sheriff's Department as as assistant sheriff. I understand that he runs little to no examinations, so two, I believe they said, last year. I have had no opportunity to talk with him. I don't know what his qualifications are or anything else. I also understand that there is another fellow in Eugene by the name of, who's the man from Eugene?
Right here.
What's the fellow?
Paul Dubner?
Dubner. I know nothing of him either. His name comes to me also Friday, and I know nothing of him. I've had no opportunity to check on him. I don't know what his qualifications are, what schools he's attended, or anything else. I'm going to check on those. Contact them. I'm going to invite you to join our Northwest Polygraph Examiners Association. We'd like to have their dues. We'd like to have their membership.
Thank you, Judge.
Has there ever been an attempt to do what you're doing here voluntarily to your Northwest Polygraphers Association? In other words, set standards and set continuing education and set qualifications so that if you are a member, then that means you meet certain standards?
Well, yes, in order to be a member of the association, you have to meet certain standards. You have to be a graduate of a school, and you have to accomplish apprenticeship and this type of thing in order to be a member of the association. Likewise, you have to be all the same qualifications in order to be a member of the American Polygraph Association.
Why isn't that enough?
Well, because there's nothing to force a man to be a member of the Northwest Polygraph Examiners Association. You know, there's nothing to force him to be a member of the APA. He can come in right strictly independent to work for you. And he doesn't have to join our organization if he doesn't want to.
Well, what I'm getting at is that I get a feeling after talking to the district attorney this morning and the former district attorney that they're going to continue to use those people, whether they're on Northwest Polygraphers Association or on a certified registered license list or whatever, they're going to continue to use those people in whom they have confidence. I would guess that lawyer, defense lawyer, is going to continue to call Derek Connell and say, who's a good polygraph examiner, rather than saying, let me see your certificate, I'd like to have you do some work. What I'm leading up to is it seems to me that it's going to be, regardless of whether you have a certificate or you're a member of an association, if you meet certain basic standards for somebody to use a polygraph examiner, you're going to have something more, and that's a personal relationship with the person asking the question. Am I wrong in that?
Well, I can't speak for Mr. Connell. I can only say that I think it's sort of like I have my own personal doctor and I keep going to him all the time. I'm sure there are other doctors that are just qualified to see him, but he's my own personal doctor and I like him. Mr. Connell seems to like the one gentleman that he spoke of, has used him quite consistently. However, he recently has broke away and is using another gentleman, Dr. Aiden, who spoke here. He's used him some. I have never had an opportunity to do any work for Mr. Connell. Due to the fact that since I have been very well known in the field, Mr. Connell has been a private attorney, and as a state police officer, we are not allowed to do private examinations, only under the request of a law enforcement agency, district attorney's order, or direct court order. Mr. Connell has hired this other gentleman strictly as a private examiner, and I'm hoping, though, however, that after we become more better known in this area, that there are a number of good private examiners on our list, that I hope we can meet Mr. McConnell and solicit his business. I'd like to keep this area. I don't see any reason to San Francisco anyway.
Other questions?
The U.S. citizenship requirement in Section 15 would preclude a Canadian undergoing American naturalization from being included in that. Is there any common basis for that requirement?
Well, really know. We do have members in Canada. In fact, we have members in Canada that are in our Northwest Polygraph Examiners Association, two very active members. I believe there is something within their position, however, that prevents them from coming down here, and I know there is some holding offices in our organization. I believe there's something that prevents them from coming into our state and accepting a polygraph examiner's license. However, I would have no hesitation in having either of those gentlemen to be in our organization or to be licensed in this state.
And then a second related question. Some years ago, over a four-year period, I had experience with a warrant officer, Army criminal investigator type, who was the one who had broken the Crown Jewel case out of World War II. So far as I know, he did not have, other than just 15 or 20 years of massive practical experience. I'm not sure if he had a polygraph examiner's course approved by the board.
Well, I would imagine, you say he was a warrant officer in the Army?
Yes.
I'm quite sure that gentleman is a graduate of the Army School at Fort Gordon. They have their own school that they run themselves, a very, very good school, very active school.
Then,
of running an examination, I think the price here now, as I say, I'm not inside this, I think it's $150.
Do you expect licensing to
increase
that cost?
To decrease it? I don't think so.
Yeah, licensing.
Well, I don't think it will have anything to do with the cost of the examination, because those who are in the field of having to pay or having to buy the license in the private field or doing sufficient examinations, $150 a minute, or let's say $100 a minute.
Thank you, Lieutenant Eagle. John
Rose. My name is John Rose. I'm a polygraph examiner, second, and investigator first. Lieutenant gave you a list of names, and I assume mine's on there since he said this. I'm a rookie at this field, so to speak, and being a beginner, I'm concerned about being licensed out of business, is my answer. I'm wondering, out of 23 names, how many are private examiners that paid their own way to school? Most of the examiners, I believe, somebody will probably correct me if I'm wrong, are paid by tax money to go to school. They're paid to go to seminars. They're paid here today. I took it on myself for a reason foreign to criminal to get into the polygraph because I was interested in it. And I think it would be a valuable tool to my business. And I took off 6 weeks from my business, went to California and attended an accredited school. Graduated, I paid about $3,000 for an instrument, and I've been doing polygraph examinations. And I went to Phoenix about 3 weeks ago to a seminar to learn something of a new technique with Dick Arthur. I had never attended one of his seminars. I was the only individual from Oregon there. Now, I don't really believe I'll get any argument when I say practice doesn't make perfect. It takes perfect practice to make perfect. You can give 12,000 examinations, and if you give all of them wrong, then you could still be giving wrong. And I agree with this licensing law. I think that it's good. It's a good concept. Any license where there is a need, I think, is good. For 6-7 years, I've been trying to give a license being law to the Senate and to the state of Oregon to license investigators. I wish we had investigators. While under the Senate Bill 47 has also a stipulation in there for licensing polygraph examiners. So we're going to have two licensing laws probably. But I think this bill could use, I'm thinking of selfish interest, and you could say that, but you've got to think
I think any man that is qualified to any position should have the right to pursue that course. And I think that if you was a police officer and viewed this law, it would be a good thing. But what if you're not a policeman? What if you're a defense attorney or an individual wanting to have an independent examination from somebody that's not a policeman? How many of those examiners on that list are non-police officers or not with non-police background? I'm really not interested in that field, but I think I should have the right to continue and pursue my course of employment as long as I keep myself updated. And if I have a disagreement with a lieutenant on the state police or some municipal government, because I examine people that have already been examined or will be examined by police, and we have already run into a conflict. And I have been told it was because of my inexperience. I disagree, and I'll continue to disagree. I think that that individual should have the right to the best polygraph examination available, whether it's and his right to have an independent, like myself or somebody from California far up, if they should choose to use me. On page 3, section 6, there's two types of license in this current time, then I'll be a second class examiner. I'll have a trainee license permits the holder to engage in an internship. Does that mean that I can't continue the practice as I have been, or will I have to hold hands with a policeman while I gave my examiner drive all the way to Portland to talk to Dr. Abrams or another private examiner who is a competitor of mine? Basically, that's about all I want to bring out, other than that I think that you're giving the this gives the board too much control, too much power over an individual. There is nowhere that I can serve on that board, and I don't think there's that many private examiners in the field today. What specific proposal for amendment? You say you indicate you favor the concept. What specific amendment would you suggest to this bill? As I said, went to an accredited school, and there's 4 or 5 today accredited schools whenever you graduate from, to meet all the specifications that they've got here, other than that you have met the graduated from the school. I felt that I was qualified when I left school, at least to practice. Is an attorney, when he passes the bar, he can go out and practice law. Well, of course, the analogy kind of breaks down there. We graduate from school, and then we have to take the bar exam, which 1 out of 3 of us fail. Now, to have an analogous situation, you graduated from school, you can take the test if you want to be like lawyers. All right. Well, I would give you a hypothetical. may have been poor. We've been through it.
For the question, I will be great. Thank you, Mr. Rose. Mr. Lim? Is there a Mr. Lim, a face, a minute?
My name is Patricia Lynn. I'm an ordained ordinary pastor for this might be 30 years. Also, 7.5 years, I've worked as a practical nurse in Illinois. I'm a trained nurse and 7.5 years in the hospital work desk, I think. As an interested citizen, I would like. Now, this would help both the examiner and the one taking the examination, I believe. I would very much like to see an amendment to your bill. And you take someone that just got half sick, coming down with a flu or something, their fingers will be. Will probably perspire after about
30 to 40 minutes under one of those exams. And they're armed with that sphygmomanometer too tight on it. Will cause swelling and your arm turns black. And finally, your shoulder aches, and it does affect the phonograph machine itself. And I do know that it could be improved. Everything, the machine can go wrong, yes. But the reactions of a person, I know that then I'm a very nervous type. I swear to God, come out alive under the examination. But it would help the examiner and the one that's taking the examination if they would consider allowing. Now, most people don't know what goes on when the tests are made or how they're given. A person taking the test is taken in to a private room, the door closed, and you're there with a stranger you've never saw before, the examiner, and you don't really know what the questions are going to be, and some could be rather shocking to a person. And they don't have to use a tape recorder as the examination is being taken. Then they could have it or not. They don't have to have it. A person that takes those voluntarily, yes. I believe they do. But when you go in there and you take an examination, if you just about have six, your heartbeat isn't normal. And if you put five, why, that's going to show up against you. And if you begin to get a fever, a raise an elevated temperature, well, you're going to have a little different reaction. You could come up with the whole thing again, and without quite realizing you're on the verge of coming down with a flu, for example. All right. I would suggest an amendment. Now, I have no access to glide. I'm not up here to be malicious or anything, but look, this would help both the one giving the examination and the one taking the examination. They don't allow anyone with you. They say, no, it'll make you nervous. Well, you know, it makes some people more nervous than if you're an attorney or someone along. They make your attorney wait outside to take you in there and shut the door. There's no window, and there's no one can watch the examination, and no one hears it. Then, when your examination is given, I would like very much to see an amendment that the person taking the examination will be allowed their attorney present if they want it. Also, probably one or two friends, like say the minister or someone that's responsible and a decent person, or a child or a young person, they might want their mother there. If she's quiet and sits back and doesn't interfere with the examination, why not? I see nothing wrong with that. Then, another thing, I would like very much to have, I forget what you call that, a two-way mirror, I guess, here, around there where others can watch the examination being given. That protects the one giving the examination as well as the one taking it. At present, they put the machinery all in back of you and constantly regulate that machine all through the examination. If they can choose, they fill with those dials. Well, I tell you, I wish that they could have their attorney and one or two other people there
as well as that thing where you can look down and have it taped, tape recorded at the top.
Well, Madam Chairman, I don't think there's anything in this bill that either says can or can't have someone else read it. Well, but that's not in this bill. I mean, they could let you, I think, if they wanted to.
Well, it could be permanent.
Yeah. People pull together to be part.
Thank you very much. It appears to me from the time it speaks that we have three more witnesses. If you will turn to Senate Bill 221, please. Jerry Van Story.
Madam Chairman,
did you want
to comment on that? No, thank you. But while they're coming up, I wonder several things that Sister Lynn mentioned and others. It seems to me that we might want to examine the practice as opposed to licensing. I can find, other than you can't use a polygraph for employment, I can find no direction in the statute. And several things have come up. The question of whether the DA can extract the stipulation for the polygraph is given, I think, is an important one. Is the attorney available, represented, present, whether you look it through a one-way mirror or available, present, and requiring a tape are all three techniques, if you will, that I don't know if they fit the licensing bill, and I'm thinking that we need another bill. If anybody else shares my concern, rather than amending this bill, having some standards for the giving of these.
I wonder if that's something we might want to ask these same people about.
Well, that's why I'm thinking another bill that should be drawn and then have them come in and speak specifically to that.
Thank Representative Pollock, can I help you? I just came to see my senator. He's busy. Is Mr. Van Storn here? He's with you. Howard Thurston?
My name is Howard Thurston. I'm an attorney.
If I interrupt, I want to go talk to Representative Paul. Am I right that this would destroy the concept of condominium?
It would destroy the leasehold condominium, I believe.
Okay, thank you. Obviously.
My name is Howard Thurston, and I'm an attorney with the law firm of Davies, Biggs, Traer, Dolan, Boley in Portland, Oregon. I represent McAdam Investors Org Limited, which is the developer of the John's Landing condominium in Portland. My primary concern with this bill has been what is, I think has been mentioned by several other senators, is my fear that it's too broad. The reference in the bill to recreational facilities and common elements. Common elements of the condominium include the land and very often the structure of the building itself. And my fear is that for practical purposes, this bill would prohibit the leasehold condominium, which is a situation where the developer does not own the fee to the property, but owns the leasehold estate, which is submitted to condominium ownership, and this is permitted by statute. That is because, obviously, in a leasehold condominium, the common elements are subject to a lease. Obviously, you cannot own a unit in the condominium unless you are party to that lease. And obviously, if you don't pay your rental for your unit, why, your unit would be foreclosed. I don't think really that it was the intention of the people, the proponents of this bill, to prohibit leasehold condominiums. I suspect that they were gearing towards a type of condominium, which I understand has been utilized in Florida, in which the purchaser of the condominium separately leases some sort of recreational facility under a long-term lease, which is very advantageous to the developer. Insofar as this bill purports to limit leasehold condominiums, I think that would be a mistake. I think those types of condominiums are quite useful, particularly where the owner of the land does not wish to sell it, and that's true in the case of most condominiums in Hawaii, where the owners of the fee just do not sell. Everything's on a leasehold there. And it also is useful in situations where the value of the land is so great that if the buyer had to purchase the fee interest in the land, the cost would be prohibitive. Examples of leasehold condominiums that we now have include John's Landing, Inn at Seventh Mountain, Spanish Head, Otter Crest, American Plaza, and the Urban Renewal Area in Portland. Beyond that, I might make a couple of personal observations. Assuming the bill could be drafted in such a way as not to relate to the leasehold condominium, I suspect that the purpose of the bill was to deal with the situation I've read about and even seen on TV about in Florida, as I mentioned. To my knowledge, no such condominium setup has ever been attempted in Oregon. In fact, I don't know of anything in this part of the country yet where a buyer has been required to enter into some lease of recreational facilities for an indefinite term, very advantageous to the developer. And just on my own personal opinion, there are so many areas of critical concern requiring legislative action, I just wonder whether it's appropriate to spend a lot of time to legislate against something which hasn't happened, and I rather doubt will ever happen for several reasons. I've read recently that the Internal Revenue Service has given some treatment to these long-term leases, which makes them very disadvantageous for the developers to utilize them in Florida.
Did you hear Senator Burbidge this morning?
Yes, I did.
It seems that he is going to further articulate what his concerns are, and perhaps if you could discuss it with him and find out what the problem really is, it might be helpful.
I'd be glad to do that.
Madam Chairman, I was going to suggest that because I have a hunch, I've not talked to Senator Burbidge, but I have a hunch that this relates directly, not specifically, to two, at least one of those presently existing developments
right.
that you related to, referred to. And I think he misses the mark of what I understand the concern was, and that you might be able to save everybody some time if you speak with him. I don't think the legislative council got what he was trying to get at, and as a layman, I'm not sure he knows precisely how to proceed in it, and we might be able to help with that. That'd be excellent.
And then we'd be glad to hear further if you have anything to call.
Fine, I'd be glad.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Vernon has almost signed up on
the 240. Can I explain it to the committee?
Mm-hmm.
And now, Senate Bill 240 is, I've put in a similar bill in the past, and it arises out of, basically out of this situation. It's a consumer bill, a consumer protection bill, really. Frequently, a contract for the purchase of a commodity like a car or a stove or a refrigerator or goodness knows what is entered into, and the purchaser becomes dissatisfied, and one of his remedies is not to pay because of his dissatisfaction. What happens very regularly is that the seller or the supplier assigns it to a collection bureau for collection. The collection bureau then brings the action against the consumer. the consumer, individually, or even if he's represented by a lawyer, is at a very distinct disadvantage, as I understand the law in Oregon. While he can claim an offset against the assignee, the collection agency, he can't assert his claim against the original seller in that proceeding. There's no way he can in our practice. So he's left with the necessity of two lawsuits if, in fact, he is going to be able to be treated fairly. First of all, he has to prove that he is entitled to an offset or a positive recovery as an offset against the assignment to the collection agency that's suing him. Then if he's going to make an affirmative recovery from the one who entered into the contract originally, he's going to have to bring a second lawsuit, because this is, I don't think, binding on the other person. He's going to have to bring a second lawsuit and affirmatively recover judgment. The second situation, I believe, we have the second one here, and that is, I'm not quite as certain of this, but we have an amendment that will clarify it, that the contract for attorney's fees, I believe, is entered into by the original seller with the original buyer. This would make it clear that if the collection agency sued me on a contract that provides for attorney's fees to the prevailing party, that if I prevail, I get a judgment for attorney's fees against the collection agency or the assignor. So I've run into this time after time after time, really. Not recently, I haven't had too many, defending too many people on collections lately, but it's a very frequent practice, and frequently the person who comes in, the reason he hasn't paid, there are always two sides, you know, a lot of them don't pay because they don't want to pay, but there are also quite a number of people who've been dissatisfied with the service rendered.
Well, on the attorney's fees, I thought we passed the bill that the contract provides you.
But I don't think, or maybe John can check this out, I'm not sure that that is necessarily binding upon the assignee of the contract. In other words, whether Wally does business, yeah. Wally represents me, he assigns it to Betty as a collection agency on a contract, she sues me as the collection agency, can I get a judgment against her, the collection agency? Or can I get a judgment against him? I ought to be able to get a judgment against him, too, for the attorney's fees that result. I don't think I might be able to get one against you, but I don't think I can get one against him for attorney's fees under our present law. I might be able to get one against
you. Why do you want to get one against me?
Maybe she's not solvent.
But he's suing me.
Let's say that Ari can prove that I have a defense and they don't get a judgment, or I can prove. There are two sides here. First, I want to be able to get a judge. I want to clarify my right to obtain attorney's fees against the non-party to the contract. Now, maybe that's clear. John can check that out for it. Maybe it's clear that I can get a judgment for attorney fees against the collection agency if I win, if I get a defendant's verdict. Okay, I want to clarify that. If it's clear, we don't need it for that purpose. Secondly, I really think, in fairness, since it was his claim originally, I ought to be able to get a positive judgment against the assignor in this proceeding, for the attorney's fees, whatever they are. And then thirdly, I want the person being sued to be able to affirmatively assert and recover from the assignor of the contract in this proceeding. So if you're going to go out and sell roofing, you should realize you can't get away from the exposure by assigning the collection to a collection agency. If you sue, there's a possibility you're going to get a judgment against you.
You're using this
change
in holding the
post office
to assign it to assignment contract.
No,
yeah.
I wanted to be able, if you do some work for me on my car, let's say, and you style it up, and then you turn the claim that you claim you repaired it over to the collection agency, I'm going to be able to counterclaim against you and recover a dozen for the damage you did to my car. Maybe I have to pay you too much, I don't know. No, I don't think you'd go back to the Asinore. You can only
go back. You can't go back, but you can assert your affirmative defense against the holder of the note.
You can do that now.
Right.
Yep.
And it would seem to me that the same theory would apply in the settlement of the contract.
You can't go back again.
You've taken over the whole obligation.
He doesn't take over the whole obligation. You see, he only takes the subject. He doesn't take over the assignee. The collection agency does not assume the obligations of the contract generally. He only assumes the benefits of the contract. I'm suggesting that the assignee is not going to be a protector against the assignor, that the person sued should be able to join the assignor to have his rights litigated in that proceeding without having to try the lawsuit twice.
You gave up the same objective, I think, right? You made it like the whole of it because the finance company wouldn't buy the contract. It would be less likely to buy the contract from a person who hadn't performed.
Well, I don't know. It depends. I don't know what the financial institution would do in this case or what effect it would have upon them. The banks, of course, like a nice, clean deal, you know, and I don't blame them. But is that good for the consumer? I think that you should be able to. I'm not talking about non-recourse paper. I wasn't thinking of that as being the main thing involved here. Well, that was my main concern, personal property. And I wouldn't have any objection to limiting it to personal property.
Well, this has been something. One more thing, the district attorneys have asked to put in a committee bill on the proceedings in breathalyzer. You may have an objection. I'm going to do it. Extend coverage to operation motor vehicles on premises open to the public makes it easier to test if alcohol content drugs is admissible in evidence. There's a recent Supreme Court.
I put it in at their request, Madam Chairman. Show it as a request. Did he plead guilty or is he being tried now? Is it being tried? Is it being tried? Thank you.